invite you to take your Bible, for the last time in this series anyway, to go to Ruth. Go to Ruth, Ruth 4. I pray you'll go to Ruth many times moving forward, but today we do close our study in Ruth. Open it up to Ruth, and we are in the final chapter. Well, as you are turning there, as you're opening to this final chapter, Ruth 4, we consider a woman, a foreigner, an alien, who stepped out in faith, a Gentile who abandoned her people and placed her faith in God. We consider a woman who, because of that faith, entered not just a family, but she entered a line. She entered a line from Abraham to David. She married a son of Abraham and had a son, and her son's name was Boaz. Boaz, that's right, we're not talking about Ruth yet. Who is this woman? Her name is Rahab. Rahab, Boaz's mother, is the one who stepped out, like Ruth, in faith from her people, embraced their God, became her God. She was the one, remember, that hid the spies before the Israelites went into Canaan. So courageously, so boldly, but so in faith, hiding the spies. And she is the one that entered the line, marrying Salmon and having Boaz. Rahab in the line, redeemed, and her faith demonstrated that. Coincidence? A very coincidental comparison to Ruth and Rahab? No, church, we know not. As we have been learning, there's no coincidences with God. That's been the theme of this study, has it not been? His hand is in every detail. This story that's reminded us of the providence of God in our poverty. This story that's reminded us of the sovereignty of God in all things. This story about a man, an Israelite, who took his family and ran. Ran to a foreign land, to Moab, in rebellion, remember? Took them, went to Moab, and dug in deep. And even after he died, his sons took Moabite wives, stayed there 10 years, childless, but they remained there for 10 years. And then, of course, they were just left with the man's wife, Naomi, and one daughter-in-law, Ruth, the remnant of that family. Remember in chapter 2, the need for food and Ruth going, having the plan to just go into the barley fields and by chance coming across this Boaz. Boaz providing much provision, but coming back to Naomi, and Naomi recognizing he can provide much more than that. This is a relative. By chance, this is a relative. And last week, we saw the prelude to redemption, remember? Boaz being greeted by this young lady at the threshing floor, gently, softly uncovering his feet. That midnight encounter, nothing shameful about it, but simply a plea for redemption. And Boaz willing, very willing. And as we left off last week, look at the end of chapter 3. With bated breath, going back to tell Naomi, Naomi says this in verse 18. She replied, "Wait, my daughter, until you learn how the matter turns out. For the man will not rest, but will settle the matter today." It's how we like with every cliffhanger, right? We don't want to wait. How will the matter turn out? And don't you love this? It will be settled today. We talked about God's economy. He doesn't wait to offer you redemption. He just offers it and gives it. That's where we left off last week. So how will it turn out? How will redemption turn out? Let's see. And we're going to look at our first point this morning. So we jump right back in. Redemption's requirement. Redemption's requirement. Look at verse 1 of chapter 4 with me. Now Boaz had gone up to the gate and sat down there, and behold, the Redeemer of whom Boaz had spoken came by. So Boaz said, "Turn aside, friend, sit down here," and he turned aside and sat down. Remember, in chapter 3, that Redeemer Boaz is speaking of is a potential kinsman Redeemer who is closer in line than Boaz is. Remember we talked about that? That was the wrinkle, remember? You'll be okay, but there's a wrinkle. There is someone closer than I that could redeem you. So that's who's in view here. And Boaz wastes no time now with this plan. He is willing. He's laid it out. And Boaz heads to the city as this chapter begins. And specifically, look at it, the gate of the city. You read that often in the Old Testament, that events happen at the city gates, right? That's not uncommon to see things happening in city gates. Now, you may just picture in your mind a simple gate. Maybe you're thinking of just a fence with a door, and you think that's the gate. But in the ancient Near East, it was much more than that. The city gates was like, it was like a structure. You had the city walls, and they were connected by like a building. That's what the city gates were. In fact, it was an enclosed structure, about 20 feet of a hallway, and it had rooms that go off the side, connecting those two walls. It was like an epicenter, really, a meeting place for the city. So it was much more than just a door that opened up. You say, well, why such an elaborate structure? Well, protecting the city is one thing, but also, as we just hinted, the city gate was where the proceedings of the town took place. The legal or judicial proceedings happened at the city gate. It was like the public square back then. That's what happened at the gate. Official business, public business. That's where the judges would reside during the time of the judges. That's where the king's delegates were during the time of the kings. Again, official business. In fact, that's why, for example, you remember when Absalom rebelled against his father? Do you remember what he did in 2 Samuel 15? He intercepts those that want to come to the city gate. What did Absalom do? He was camped out by the city gate, and when people came and they wanted a hearing with the king, he would intercept them. He was at the city gate for all of those interactions, those public discourses. That's what he did. He went to the focal point of the city, right? Because that's where all the judicial matters would be heard. So this is where we're getting familiar with the locale now that we're in. Same idea here. Boaz headed to the place of official public business, the gate. The gate. So Boaz heads there, sits down, as verse 1 tells us, and lo and behold, who just happens to walk by? Who just happens to walk by? The potential redeemer, the wrinkle, the one that Boaz had spoken of. And at this point, we know there's absolutely no chance. Don't you love the beholds in there? There's absolutely no chance, right? The narrator making that very clear. This is no chance happening. And what does he do? He calls him to sit down with him, along with others. Look at this in verse 2. Not just the unknown redeemer. Look who else. Verse 2. And he took 10 men of the elders of the city and said, sit down here. So they sat down. 10 men of the elders of the city. That is, friends, specific individuals. Do you see that? Very, very important this morning. He doesn't just grab anyone that happens to pass by. I need a quorum of 10. Let me just grab the first 10 that come by. They'll be it. You see the 10 men of the elders of the city. Very intentional. He needs a specific type of individual. These are public figures, recognized, respected elders of the city. And this helps us grab the scene here. This is a public hearing in full view, overseen by an official panel, if you will. And if you're thinking that sounds like a courtroom to me, you'd be exactly right. That's the motif here. It's like a courtroom, right? A judicial proceeding. It's very legal, very judicial. And that is one, as we begin this morning, one requirement of redemption. You see that? One requirement of redemption, that judicial framework we see here. And we're going to come back to that. All right, the court is assembled. Let's turn now to the proceedings. Look at verse 3. Then he said to the redeemer, Naomi, who has come back from the country of Moab, is selling the parcel of land that belonged to our relative Elimelech. So I thought I would tell you of it and say, buy it in the presence of those sitting here and in the presence of the elders of my people. If you will redeem it, redeem it. But if you will not, tell me that I may know. For there is no one besides you to redeem it, and I come after you. And he said, I will redeem it. With the court in session there, Boaz declares that there's a parcel of land that belongs to Elimelech. It's interesting. It somehow is now part of the redemption price. Now, that may seem out of the blue for us, and you might be saying, well, where is this coming from all of a sudden? I'm talking about redeeming Ruth. Why are we talking about land? Well, listen, this was very common back then because land was very common to Israel. When they went into the land, what did they receive? The land. Land was always the promise from God. Every Israelite was given a parcel of land, was given a portion of land. But God made very clear in the conquest, it wasn't their land. It was whose land? His land. So in one sense, the land given to each Israelite was on loan from God. Similar to us today, right? We recognize, we talked about this morning, everything we have is on loan from God. Same idea in the Old Testament when they went into the land. And again, Leviticus 25 gives very clear instructions from God how to manage that land. Again, it's his land on loan. And the law, in that law in Leviticus, states that if the Israelite was to come into any kind of turmoil and they had to try and sell the land, make some profit from it because they were destitute, eventually in God's grace and providence, it would come back to them. And the year of Jubilee where it's given back to the Israelite graciously by God. So in poverty, remember Elimelech, remember the famine, very likely has sold off his piece of land before he goes to Moab. Now listen, we don't know all the finer details of that transaction, but it's very clear in the text. Elimelech, his land, sells it in some capacity, and now it needs to be redeemed. It needs to be brought back. And it's a very important piece of this transaction with Ruth. And this would be common again. What's important here is that Boaz comes out first with this. Do you see that? Doesn't come out with Ruth. Do you notice? He comes out first to say there's land. Land to be redeemed. And of course, we know there's more behind that land from Elimelech, Ruth, that's in need of redemption. However, Boaz begins with the land. And of course, listen, as it always is today, land is always attractive, is it not? Land is always attractive. One can imagine the excitement of that unnamed redeemer. A piece of land? Maybe he had no idea. Maybe he didn't know. And now a public sitting to make it his own. It's right there. You can have that parcel of land. You can just imagine his excitement. He's salivating. You mean, I'm going to get this land. Now we get his response, which is no shock, right? End of verse 4. Look at it. I will redeem it. Of course. Of course. I mean, Boaz just said it's you or me, and he's offering it up. I'm in. All good until this wrinkle from Boaz. Look at verse 5. Then Boaz said, "The day you buy the field from the hand of Naomi, you also acquire Ruth, the Moabite, the widow of the dead, in order to perpetuate the name of the dead in his inheritance." Listen, lots of legality and legalese may be in play here, but one thing is for sure included in this transaction is Ruth, I mean, the language, look at the language again. It hints at the reality that there is, note this, look very carefully, there's nothing extra that needs to be paid. In one sense, if we could say this crassly, Ruth is a throw-in to this deal, right? You get Ruth along with the land. This is like what you see in advertising all the time, right? You buy this and you will get this, right? Even more, at no extra cost to you. Now we have Boaz making clear, not just that point, but note what he says. The moral obligations. Look again at verse 5. Ruth, the Moabite, the widow of the dead, in order to. Here's the underlying reason. Here's why this is important. Here's why you need to look at Ruth. To perpetuate the name of the dead in his inheritance. Boaz points to the moral obligations under the law. Do you see that? He's pointing and saying to his kinsmen, we have a moral obligation. You are in line to redeem this young lady. Amazing. In other words, our relative has died and his name is dying out. Our relative is dead and his line will die. And here you can acquire, can redeem Ruth in order to perpetuate his name. Many would turn that around and say the moral obligation should be in front. The land is the bonus, right? The land is a bonus to doing what's morally right. And look what Boaz does, that man of morality. He turns it around and comes out with the land first. Now listen, to be sure, we don't know all the details of eligibility when you think about this unknown redeemer in Boaz. The text doesn't get into all of that, but what is clear is that he's able to do it. We don't know his marital status, all of those different things. We know it was a different time back then. The key is he is able to do it because it's being offered to him. Unknown redeemer, like Boaz, was able to redeem Ruth, as any offer recognizes, right? Any offer to you recognizes your ability to take it. And that's the same here. So note this, he's financially able, genetically eligible, and morally responsible. That's where this unknown redeemer just stands with that. Even more, he's already agreed. Note this, he's already agreed to the land. You remember his zest? I will do it. I will do it. The only difference now in the picture is what? Ruth. Ruth. This young lady whose fame was known, this loyal, faithful lady, as Boaz recognized. Unknown redeemer, what do you say to that in light of her fame in the town? Will you redeem? Look at verse 6. Then the redeemer said, I cannot redeem it for myself, lest I impair my own inheritance. Take my right of the redemption yourself, for I cannot redeem it. In other words, take Ruth. Whoa. I mean, that changes everything. I mean, what about me? Take her for my own? What about my inheritance? Do you see that dripping off this unknown redeemer? The unknown redeemer's focus is in full view here, right? You know where the camera lens is pointed with him. Squarely on his own affairs. The acquisition of land is one thing. I mean, that can only bring more gain. But the acquisition of a widow, and by extension, her widowed mother-in-law, right? Not mentioned here, but by implication. Well, this unknown redeemer says, nothing there is for me. I see no profit in her, in this, for me. The time, the resources, so much of himself that would have to be given to her, and even more, what about his inheritance? What about his inheritance? What about his line? What about that? Again, there's so many details here. We don't want to get caught in the weeds. We've talked about the laws for levirate marriage, which is a relative redeeming the line when one dies out without a child. And in there, one of the stipulations God gives is the firstborn son, when that's redeemed, would get the resources, would get everything in line, and in this case, with Elimelech. Resources go back to his name and to his family. What's missing here in this unknown redeemer's plight is beyond that one-time transaction, that temporal redemption, everything is still his. His name still is propagated. He could have 2, 3, 4, 5 sons. But no, that firstborn, taking the time, taking the effort to redeem, he wants none of it. In fact, I could say this to you, friends, his protest is more material-driven. His time, his resources that would go into Ruth and Naomi, his stuff, at least in that firstborn, now tied to Elimelech. Well, that's sharing. That's giving. And he wants no part of that. That's his beef. However, where Boaz looked at this potential wife and saw Ruth the blessing, I mean a loyal, faithful, determined, resourceful young woman seeking God, this unknown redeemer looked at this woman and saw Ruth the obstacle. Ruth the obstacle, a widow, a Moabite no less, and likely with another widow in tow, that Naomi. This unknown redeemer couldn't stop tripping over himself when viewing her. Whereas Boaz only thought of Ruth and of Naomi, remember him considering her with food last week as he considered redemption. And so the unknown redeemer lets go of his right and says, I cannot redeem it. Harkens back, this is Israel's history, is it not? What does it remind you of? Remember Genesis 25? Who was it that sold his birthright because his tummy was growling? Esau. In a moment, and we've all been ravaged, right, with hunger. In a moment, what does he do in that moment of rationalization? What good is my birthright to me? I'm hungry. And he sells away the birthright, and we know what happens to Esau and his line after that moment. In the same way, we have this unknown redeemer looks at Ruth, this woman seeking God's own heart, and says, I cannot redeem it. And we know nothing more about him to this day. Gone. But you certainly know about Boaz in the line. Amazing. Esau lost the line. This unknown redeemer lost the line. And here the unknown redeemer again, so concerned with his inheritance, lost now in history forever. His inheritance, his line, the very thing he held up as the reason why he couldn't, is gone. No line, no genealogy with his name at all. So the proceedings continue. Look at verse 7 with me. Now this was the custom in former times in Israel concerning redeeming and exchanging. To confirm a transaction, the one drew off his sandal and gave it to the other, and this was the manner of attesting in Israel. So when the redeemer said to Boaz, buy it for yourself, he drew off his sandal. This is another bracket-like piece. Remember the beginning of chapter 2, we had the bracket piece of, by the way, you're going to be introduced to Boaz? This is the same thing. It's kind of like a step aside, a little parenthesis there to explain. And this is a clue, by the way, that Ruth was written to generations down the line. They wouldn't have known about this ancient historical thing that happened, this transaction sealer, if you will. So the narrator has to bring them back into that context. So the custom of that time, when a deal was done, the sandal was taken off and given as an emblem of the transaction, right? Is a way to say, I'm giving you my sandal, my important sandal. This seals the transaction so that everyone will know this is an official deal. That's what they did back then, and that's what sealed the transaction here. Now listen, it's good to know these ancient customs, right, when we come to it. If I'd say to you, for no other reason, it's like our handshake today, and we're all grateful that we do it by handshake now, and we're not exchanging shoes, right? But that was the same idea, that you shake a hand on it, you say your word, that's our custom today. Back then, it was the sandal exchange. So with that sandal exchange, the transaction's complete. We continue in verse 9. And Boaz said to the elders and all the people, you are witnesses this day that I have bought from the hand of Naomi all that belonged to Elimelech, all that belonged to Chilion and Mahlon, and also Ruth the Moabite, the widow of Mahlon. I have bought to be my wife, to perpetuate the name of the dead and his inheritance, that the name of the dead may not be cut off from among his brothers and from the gate of his native place. You are witnesses this day. That is just an amazing declaration from Boaz, right? And look what is the majority of content there, talking about what he has done for Ruth. You are witnesses, Boaz says as he looks around. In other words, it is official. It's finished. The deed is done. And pay attention to Boaz's boast. Like I said, what's the greatest amount of content there in verse 10? I redeemed Ruth the Moabite, the widow, to perpetuate the name of the dead in his inheritance. And on he goes. Amazing. Boaz, so concerned about the inheritance of his relative. Do you see his focus? That's his boast. In fact, you could say he's boasting about it. We have saved him. I've redeemed him. He will not go down dead without a line. Amazing. His focus is Elimelech. And don't miss the contrast to the unknown redeemer, so focused on his lot. Finally, this transaction, this redemption purchased, and it's sealed with a blessing. Sealed with a blessing comes from an unlikely place, but look at verse 11. Then all the people who were at the gate and the elders said, we are witnesses. May the Lord make the woman who is coming into your house like Rachel and Leah, who together built up the house of Israel. May you act worthily in Ephrathah and be renowned in Bethlehem. And may your house be like the house of Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah, because of the offspring that the Lord will give you by this young woman. Amazing. The first one there, look at it. May the Lord make the woman like Rachel and Leah. That's an appeal to the Lord for his building up. Do you see that? For his watering. Appealing to Yahweh, to the Lord, to build up. Like he did with Rachel and Leah. And how did he do that? Building up the house of Israel? Well, that's where the 12 tribes of Israel came from, right? Along with their maidservants, of course. 12 tribes of Israel from Jacob's house. And one of those tribes, coming from Leah, right, was Judah. And we'll keep Judah in mind and return to him in a moment. A son who just happened to be, just by way of our own bracket right now, a great-great-grandfather of Boaz. That's what Judah was. The witnesses here pray a blessing on Ruth, that God, through now Ruth and her redemption and her union with Boaz, that God would build up Israel through her. Listen, they had no idea, did they, what God was really doing through that redemption. Think about it as we step back. That was their prayer, that God would build up Israel. They have no idea how he was going to build up Israel. Amazing, that's one. Number two, may you act worthily in Ephrathah, and be renowned in Bethlehem. As we've talked about this before, the beginning of Ruth, Ephrathah was noted in chapter 1, and it's another name for Bethlehem. It really is just a pseudonym, another name, a region, some speculate of Bethlehem, so we don't want to get tripped up on that. We're talking about the same place. But the witnesses here pray for blessings on Boaz's name. Do you see that? Interestingly, blessings for the name of a man, Boaz, who is concerned about anything else but what? His own name. And they pray for his name and his renown. Isn't that amazing? Boaz, who's not focused or preoccupied with his inheritance, his name, his stuff at all. In fact, Boaz's preeminent preoccupation is another, Elimelech. And isn't that amazing? He gets this prayer that his name would be renowned. That's the second part of the blessing. And let's look at the third. May your house be like the house of Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah. You get some new names there. The house of Perez. Who is Perez? Well, the text tells us who Tamar bore to Judah. So we see that this Perez is a son of Judah. Judah, we just mentioned, of course, is one of Jacob's sons, a son of the line. Well, Judah, in turn, had a son. And actually, it was in a very similar, what's called a levirate marriage, a relative redeeming marriage situation. However, it was very much the opposite to what we read in Ruth. Very much the opposite. Genesis 38 recounts of those 12 brothers. One day, Judah has a fancy, and he just leaves them. Then he goes to Adullam, and he sets up shop in Adullam, and he takes a Canaanite wife in Adullam. A Canaanite wife who gives him three sons. Three sons. He takes those three sons, and they are wicked. Wicked, wicked sons. He has Tamar, who is selected by him to be the wife of that first. The first son is so wicked that he dies in God's sight. The text makes very clear he is so wicked that he dies. So, of course, Judah and Tamar look to get redeemed. This seed, this line needs to be redeemed. They have no kids. They look to the second. The second is called upon to go and redeem Tamar. Well, he pretends to do the thing. He goes in, and wickedness in God's sight again kills him. The text makes clear on the spot. He is done. The father, Judah, of course, is very afraid at this point. He doesn't want to lose a third son. Of course, all of his sons are wicked. So he withholds his third son from Tamar. Right? Think about the moral obligations to continue the line. Withholds. You can imagine Tamar thinking, will I have any redemption? Time goes on. Judah's wife dies. And in his mourning, the text says, he goes to look comfort. And he goes to places of the city he shouldn't go. Tamar, seizing the opportunity, dresses up as a prostitute. Dresses up as a prostitute, intercepts Judah. He has no idea. And they lie together. Of course, there's many other details about he's called out for his hypocrisy and whatnot, but from that incestual union of Judah and Tamar come two twins, Perez and Hezron. The line propagated through that very different levirate marriage situation, was it not? I mean, it's almost the polar opposite of what you get in Ruth. But the key is, Perez comes through all of that wickedness, stands in the line. A very different set of circumstances. However, listen, this is the point of Genesis 38 to Ruth. God working no less. And these names we know. And through all of that mess emerges, consider Perez, son of Judah. And again, we'll see even more than that in a moment. And think about that. If God can propagate the royal line through such wickedness, these witnesses understood in terms of their reference to Perez. Think about this. This is the point of them bringing up Perez. If God can propagate the line, if he can build up through such wickedness, how much more in righteousness? Do you see that? That's the point. And these witnesses get it. How much more, God, will you do with the righteous, with the Boaz, with the Ruth? And that's their prayer here. These witnesses understood that. They understood not only that, what God could do, but they also understood that everything was present for that pure and right redemption. This is the important piece in this point. Everything was present in this scenario needed for genuine, true redemption. By way again, of just making sure they're clear in our mind, there's five of them. Let's look at them. Five of them. Number one, a public hearing. We've looked at it already. What's a requirement for redemption? A public hearing. We have that here. They're at the city gate. Legal. Nothing in a back room. Everything in full view. Number two, not only a public hearing, but an official, legal, witnessed transaction. Again, this is not something that goes on and then you just, you get a little blurb about it later and you're still wondering what happened. This is in public legal view. Number three, legal witnesses, not just to anything, but witnessing one who is eligible one who is eligible. You see that Boaz is eligible. He is kin. He actually is eligible to redeem. He's a kin. Number four, we have one not only eligible, but one who is able. Boaz is able. It means he's wealthy. He's a man of resource. And again, by implication, we understand that he can take Ruth to be his wife. And finally, five, this would be the most important characteristic. Not only eligibility, not only ability, but willingness. You see that? What was missing with the unknown redeemer? I cannot redeem it. Isn't it interesting? It doesn't say, I cannot redeem her. I cannot redeem it. I cannot redeem it. The willingness of Boaz, not focused on himself or his inheritance, but his kin's. Those are crucial requirements to redemption that we see in this story. They're all here, but that's not all. It's not just redemption and that's it. Redemption has effects, and that's our next point. Redemption's result. Redemption's result. Look at verse 13 as we continue. So Boaz took Ruth, and she became his wife. And he went into her, and the Lord gave her conception, and she bore a son. Simple, simple verse there, right? But the redemption happens. Boaz redeems Ruth. She becomes his wife. Think about that. Ruth, the Moabite, becoming Boaz, the Israelite's wife. Ruth from foreigner, Moabite, and widow to adopted Israelite wife, child of God. Amazing. And we note here the first result of adoption is what? Of redemption is what? Adoption. New identity. Amazing. From foreigner to favor, from lost to found, from widow to wife. That's redemption. You have a new identity. That is the first effect of redemption. A new identity. And then this, look at the end of verse 13. After the marriage is official, what? Ruth bears a son. A son, the next byproduct of this redemption, an offspring, a child, the very thing that is prayed for, right? The propagation, one to come, a son. And by the way, presumably this son is a wedding night baby. That is pretty clear in the text. And you say, well, why that detail? Why is that important? If you look at the verse again, it is made very clear it happens instantaneously. That is very important because Ruth, along with her sister-in-law, both went 10 years barren in rebellion. One decade empty in sin, one night full. Very important detail here in Ruth that the narrator wants to draw your attention to. God can do whatever he wants to. Again, very different time, very different story, but a very critical detail here. Just in one night, she is able to conceive. Continued evidence of a sovereign hand at its work here. He is the one who fills, the one who provides in famine, the one who provides in barrenness, and the one that is about to be recognized and praised. Look at verse 14. Then the woman said to Naomi, "Blessed be the Lord, who has not left you this day without a redeemer. And may his name be renowned in Israel. He shall be to you a restorer of life and a nourisher of your old age, for your daughter-in-law who loves you, who is more to you than seven sons, has given birth to him." You had the chorus of witnesses before. Now you have the women's chorus, likely the women in Boaz's house, maybe the women of the town that have come in, really providing a dramatic backdrop to this scene as they begin a chorus now in light of these effects. They provide, again, this background voice, if you will, that are pointing us to the continued results of redemption. A new identity, a son for Ruth, and now for Naomi here, look at it, restoration, nourishment in her old age. They point right to Naomi and say, you have been blessed. You will be restored. That is vitality from redemption. You receive new identity. You receive a propagation, a sustenance. And now you receive vitality. Now, hearing that, you may be tempted to think that that restoration is from Ruth, right? The very thing. Young Ruth, loyal Ruth. And doesn't the chorus say in verse 15, look at it, to Naomi, that her daughter-in-law, Ruth, is more to her than seven sons? I mean, that's quite a statement. In fact, it's an amazing statement in the ancient Near East where a son was everything, right? You talk about propagating a line and a name, a son was heralded. That's just the way it was back then. And even more, seven sons, seven, a very special number in the ancient Near East. It was thought if you had one son, you were something. If you had seven, well, that's just divine. And what does the chorus say here? Take the seven sons so revered in the ancient Near East, Ruth is better than that. That's what they're saying to her. Ruth is better than that. It's an amazing statement. The women are looking, when they say that, not just at Ruth, but note this, it's not directly to her, but beyond Ruth, to a redeemer. That's what he's called. Look at verse 14. You say, oh yes, of course, right, Boaz. And friends, it's not Boaz they're talking about. I want us to track carefully. Let's reread these verses to see exactly who they're talking about. Look with me at verse 14 again. Then the women said to Naomi, blessed be the Lord who has not left you this day without a redeemer. Okay, we're talking about a redeemer. And may his name be renowned in Israel. He shall be to you a restorer of life and a nourisher of your old age. For your daughter-in-law who loves you, who is more to you than seven sons, has given birth to him. Your daughter-in-law who loves you has given birth to him. Him, who is that? By gender, it can't be Ruth. And by nature, it can't be Boaz. Do you see that? Keep reading in verse 16. Then Naomi took the child and laid him on her lap and became his nurse. Who is him? That baby in Naomi's lap. He is the one. That symbol of attachment. She takes the baby, puts the baby in her lap. Him represented, that redemption, that new redeemer now represented in that baby is restoration, nourishment, and redemption. Wait a minute, redemption, you might say. I thought that was Boaz here. I thought Boaz has been the one. Isn't he the kinsman redeemer? Isn't he been doing the redeeming in Ruth? Indeed he has. But now, friends, the focus turns to the son. And who is this son? Let's look at verse 17. We'll get his name. And the women of the neighborhood gave him a name, saying, a son has been born to Naomi. They named him Obed. He was the father of Jesse, the father of David. The son, Obed, you see that there? He is in view now. He's the focus. He is the one. That baby is the one that they're referring to when they talk about restoration and redemption. You say, a baby? Really, that baby is a symbol of restoration and redemption? Yes, Obed is. A name, Obed, by the way, means servant. That's what that name means. Obed is a root. You get Obadiah and other names. It means servant, and it's a very fitting name for this son, who indeed will continue this redemption. And note this, serve the line. He is going to serve the line, if you will. And the women sing this chorus, and it's really based on Obed's birth, not Boaz's past action, Obed's birth, a son to carry on. However, when you think about that, what the women are saying, it's almost a prophetic chorus, isn't it? Obed is it to them, right? I want us to now start thinking big. Obed is the terminus. Obed is it. Obed, this young life, what does youth represent? Potential, health, vitality. Obed will do the thing, and he will take you, Boaz and Ruth, into your old age. You have Obed. Obed will serve the line. And he, I'm sure, although we don't know, will take care of his parents, no doubt about that. But he will serve the line by fathering a son by the name of Jesse. Jesse, who maybe you don't know, but you certainly do know his son. And Jesse's son is David. David, that is King David. The most famous king, the most famous name in all of Israel to this day. The slayer of Goliath, the military might, David, the man after God's own heart, you know him. You know him. All of a sudden, that David, you know, and his name, that David, appears in this account. Coincidence? Just one of those interesting little tidbits? A neat little family connection? Is that, oh, isn't that interesting? Boaz and David are related. Church, what have we learned in this study? There is no coincidence. The narrator pointing you to something greater going on. Christian, we have been moving around something like a little hall closet, bedroom closet, and you have just stepped out into the room. All of a sudden you realize I'm in something just a little bigger. You look around that room, it's modest, it's small, it's a small drop of Bethlehem during a point of time in the Judges. Yet this verse 17 has a step out of that closet into a room. And maybe you realize you're in the middle. Maybe it's just hitting you. Maybe you realize you're in the middle right now of something much bigger than Obed, much bigger than Boaz, much bigger than Ruth. Boaz, the redeemer here in Ruth, had a son, Obed, himself a redeemer, called here in the text. redeeming the line and fathering a son, Jesse, who too had a son, David. David, King David, the great Redeemer King of Israel, saving Israel from its enemies. That David in the line of Jesse, Obed, and Boaz, and more. Look at verse 18. Now these are the generations of Perez. There he is, Perez. Remember him. Perez fathered Hezron. Hezron fathered Ram. Ram fathered Amminadab. Amminadab fathered Nashon. Nashon fathered Salmon. Salmon fathered Boaz. Boaz fathered Obed. Obed fathered Jesse. Jesse fathered David. Do you remember the wickedness that brought Perez into the world? From the wicked backdrop that brought Perez into the line to the righteous account that we have here that brought Boaz in. None accidental, none a mistake, none merely luck, none by chance. Nothing unknown. Instead, mark this, friends, all according to God's plan. And that's the point of this genealogy here that ends the book. That's the point. This account is for God's people to encourage them and remind them of the results of redemption, the grand plan of God. Often unseen, I would submit to you, very often unseen. We don't see it, do we? You didn't see the bedroom in the closet because you can't. So often it's not seen. Not seen during our time, like it would be here, the hand of God unseen, but always there. No detail left out, nothing wasted. And you realize, Christian, as you live your life, you're living a life that's much bigger than you. But aren't you comforted by the fact there's a sovereign hand over you, orchestrating, working through, directing all the pieces? You're in his hands. This is nothing chaotic here. And the narrator here likely writing to encourage God's people, like, I pray it's an encouragement to you today. During the time of David, maybe the same David, maybe it was during the time of 2 Samuel 11 where they couldn't believe King David would do what he did with Bathsheba and commit adultery. Maybe his people were reeling and said, that can't be. What good can come of that now? What good can come of that? Or maybe it was afterwards. Maybe it was the kingdom dividing, spiraling. Maybe even later, who knows, torn apart at any point. At any point where God's child says, where is God in this? Maybe it's a time such as this book was written. Maybe God's people wondering, where is God? And maybe, Christian, it's crossed your mind, maybe this week, maybe this month, maybe this year, we don't need to recount what's gone on in the world over the past few weeks. You know it full well. And maybe you have said at some point in your quietest moments, God, where are you in this? I just see lives being lost. I see my life falling apart. I see destruction, chaos, sin, evil. Where are you, God, in this? Where are you? That's the question we started with, remember, a few weeks ago, and it's a good one, and it's a very important one. For everyone who calls on the name of the Lord, that's a very important question. And remember, God never leaves you hanging. Turn to Matthew 1. Turn to Matthew 1. Matthew 1, is what begins the New Testament. The new testimony, if you will, it comes out of the gates with Matthew, Matthew's gospel account. Seems pretty innocent, right? Matthew, the Jew of Jews, in a sense, writing to the Jews. But he opens with this genealogy, and it's an interesting one as he opens his book. Read along with me, and look with me, I should say, in chapter 1. The book of the genealogy of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham. Abraham was the father of Isaac, and Isaac the father of Jacob. Jacob the father of Judah and his brothers, and Judah the father of Perez and Zerah by Tamar, and Perez the father of Hezron. Hezron the father of Ram, and Ram the father of Abinadab, and Abinadab the father of Nashon, and Nashon the father of Salmon. Salmon the father of Boaz by Rahab, and Boaz the father of Obed by Ruth, and Obed the father of Jesse, and Jesse the father of David the king. You look at that line there, and you see a lot of sin, don't you? I mean, look right at the top at Abraham. Those of us that know Abraham's life, Abraham didn't just lie once, he lied twice about Sarah. Twice he lied. Jacob deceived his father in one of the most notorious acts of deception. Deceived his ailing father. Judah, whose wickedness we've already talked about. And I mean, we didn't even begin to get into the wickedness Judah brought into that account. And what about David, whose sin with Uriah's wife is infamous? Is God in this? Is he? Is he in this? Take a look at verse 3. The father of Perez and Zerah by Tamar. Look at verse 5. Salmon, the father of Boaz by Rahab. Boaz, the father of Obed by Ruth. Verse 6. David was the father of Solomon by the wife of Uriah. Four interesting bys there. Almost like just stand by, just pause, take a look at what we've just read. And zone in on that one we started with, by Rahab, just a virtue of one. So Boaz's mom is who? Rahab. Wow, that's a small world, isn't it? You might say, what a coincidence. Keep reading, by Ruth, right? By the wife of Uriah. Who are these ladies that are popping into this account? I thought this was just giving the seed, right? Going down. No, there's something else going on in here. Why are there Gentiles popping into this account? This very Jewish book, this very Jewish account. Why are those Gentiles popping in? Why are those sinners popping in there? Is God in this? Maybe, but it could still just be interesting. It could be just a scribal addition just to get those conspiracy theories going, right? Just could be just that scribal addition saying, well, didn't you know this? Let's see where this is going. As we scan to the end of the line, look at verse 16. And Jacob, as we go through all the line, all the bloodline, the plumb line, the relative line, and Jacob, the father of Joseph, the husband of Mary, of whom Jesus was born, who is called Christ. How Christ would be Jesus Christ, the Son of God, the one we have been studying in the Gospel of Mark, God in flesh. Is God in this? God is right in this. Do you see that? God smack dab in the middle of it. God in flesh. God in flesh. More than any one of them could have ever imagined, God is in this. In Westmount, God didn't look at this mess and say, like that unknown redeemer, God didn't look at this mess and say, I cannot redeem it. I cannot redeem it. It's just a mess. I can't redeem it. I can't redeem it. No, instead, he decided to what? Come down, condescend, descend into the mess, into the line, into the sin. Said, I'm coming in it, in the middle of it. He entered the mess. He entered the sin for us, for you. He entered into it. And why? Because he loved us, no doubt. We love John 3:16, for God so loved the world. That's why, in one sense, he did it. But also, and here's the key, this is what we've learned in Ruth. He's the only one that could. He is the only one that met the requirements for redemption. Not the real estate, not the inheritance, all of those temporal things that people could redeem and should and did. No, we're talking about eternal redemption, eternity. He met the requirements, all five of them. Number one, he is the only one that is eligible. He's the only one that is fully God and fully man. Colossians 2:9 says this, in him the whole fullness of deity dwells bodily. That is deity, friends, in body. That's God's deity in flesh. Man's problem, so God became man. Man's mess, so God became man. Do you see that? Christ is eligible to pay the price because he is fully man. That's one. Two, however, he is also able. He's eligible, but he's also able. It's one thing to be eligible as a man. He's fully man. Another thing to be able. Listen, only a rich man can pay a rich debt. Only a rich man can pay a rich debt. Christ is fully man, came to earth, and lived a perfect life. That's the debt. Book of James tells us, even but one sin and we're lawbreakers, and we know what we deserve. Christ came down, he condescended, he descended, he entered into the mess. In the mess all around him, can you just imagine? Judas as a wingman, all of this stuff all around him, he entered into that, and he lived a perfect life. And by as such, he earned ability to pay the price we can't. We can't pay it. We are like the debtor standing in the courtroom. We can't pay anything because we're in debt. Jesus has no debt, and he can pay it. He's a perfect man, a perfect God-man. Christ lived a perfect life. Matthew 5:17, we're told that Christ came to fulfill the law. Praise God. He fulfilled the law. A passage embedded in a whole Sermon on the Mount that talks about kingdom entry, all right, through Christ and his perfection. Three, eligibility, ability, they're very necessary, but one can have those things and not be willing, right? The unknown Redeemer was very eligible, and he was very able, but was he willing? Absolutely not. Yet the Redeemer himself says this in John 10:18, no one takes my life from me, and I lay it down because I was forced. No, I lay it down of my own accord. Do you see that? That's voluntary. The force of that verse is, no one's demanded this of me. And I know you're a mess, and I know it's a mess, but I'm going to lay down my life for that mess. That's what it says. That's willingness. Christ laid down his life of his own will voluntarily. Four, that laid down life was not a token. It's not a nice gesture. You hear that so often today, that Jesus is some great moral example. He's just that ancient Arab that put himself on that tree. That's what you hear today. Just a great example. Middle Eastern man that did a really nice thing, and we're remembering it for years to come. Beloved, it was so much more than that. It was a payment. Christ made a payment on that tree, a divine payment. It's called a propitiation, a big word that means an appeasement for sin. God the Father, Almighty God, needed appeasement. 1 John 2:2 says that Christ is the propitiation for our sins. Listen to what Paul picks up in Romans 8, verse 3. For God has done what the law, weakened by the flesh, could not do by sending his own Son in the likeness of sinful flesh and for sin. He condemned sin in the flesh because of his perfect life, in order that the righteous requirement of the law might be fulfilled in us, who walk not according to the flesh, but according to the Spirit. In other words, God sent his Son to do what we couldn't do, to fulfill the law, to fulfill the demands of the law, to make a propitiation so that we don't face hell. And Christ stands in our place. Five, this redemption was not hidden, but it was public, very public. This purchase was public. Christ hung on that tree, beaten, scorned, forsaken. We picture that, don't we, around resurrection time. Very publicly shamed, hanging on that tree. Public execution, but listen, public resurrection. A resurrection attested by many witnesses, as Paul reminds us in 1 Corinthians 15, that he appeared to more than 500 brothers. There's nothing hidden about that. It's not like, by the way, I heard that Jesus is walking. No, 500, over 500 he appeared to. All going, all proclaiming, all public witnesses to the risen Christ. Friends, those are the requirements of our redemption. All met and only met by the Christ. He's the only one that could. Now, Christian, you live in the results of that redemption. You have been adopted. You have a new identity and a new name in the book of life because of Christ. And maybe you're coming to understand new implications of your redemption every day. Maybe. Each and every day you see it. Maybe you realize now there are things that you could never see when you were walking in that valley. You could just never see them. Like Naomi, who thought redemption meant the provision of food, protection, and care. That was her terminus. That was her end. That Ruth will just get by. And if someone will provide for us, that was her ceiling. We could just get by. What about like the women who thought redemption meant the birth of Obed, a son to carry? Obed was it. And Obed was the end of the line, and he was the ceiling, and with Obed, you'll be able to be okay. Maybe like the narrator who thought redemption meant the line to David. David was it. King David. I mean, that's special. King David is it. Maybe you realize now as you step back and consider the big cosmic picture that God is at work in ways that you don't know, but you can't know. You can't possibly know. If these children of God had no idea in their circumstances, the bigger picture, Christian, it's true that we can't possibly know either with what you're going through today. You can't possibly know what God is doing. But in light of this book, you may not know how he's at work in the details and the eventual outcomes, but you can trust that he is. and you can live by faith, and you can walk in faith. And like Rahab, who had no idea that it was not just her family that was being redeemed as she bravely hid the spies and tied that scarlet cord in faith. That scarlet cord represented, little did she know, more than a family saved, but a line redeemed. A line weaving through unrighteousness like Judah. Can you imagine? The tribe that bears his name, a man of wickedness. A line weaving through the righteous like Boaz, also redeemed. And a line that would end in Jesus Christ, the Redeemer. He is the Redeemer. The Redeemer provided in our poverty to every single one of us who call on his name. We too will be called redeemed. Father, we thank you for that grand plan of redemption that at one point in our lives we had no idea as we lived our own lives, as we sought our own inheritance. We had no idea the grand plan, and then we were saved. And we had no idea, Lord, what salvation truly and really meant. God, you began to open our eyes more and more. We knew we were saved from hell. We had no idea the glory that you had in store, Lord, as your name would be proclaimed and more would be snatched on their road to their own inheritance. Father, we thank you so much that you have given us opportunity to be redeemed. Lord, we consider these accounts and we consider you could have stood like the unknown Redeemer and said, I can't do it. It's a mess. She's a mess. He's a mess. But you didn't. And Father, we are so grateful that in your divine decree, in your sovereignty, in your almighty power and providence, you redeemed us. God, thank you. Help us, Lord, to live in light of that redemption. Lord, may we go out infused with every step, every word, every thought, every deed, infused with redemption that now flows through us, that we are engrafted. We too as Gentiles, we too as sinners, engrafted into the line with our names in the book of life. Oh God, please let us bear that at the forefront of our minds with no matter what you providentially and sovereignly allow to come across our path. God, we thank you for this journey through this book and all that you have taught us, Lord, that you are always in control. We may step out of the closet into the room into the hall into the home, but it's always much bigger than we think, Father. And we thank you so much that it is, and again, that you've allowed us to. And we give thanks and praise in the name of our Redeemer, Jesus Christ. Amen.